This is case number 57364, Orozco versus Thornton Concrete Pumping et al. Mr. Potter?
Thank you,
Judge. And whatever time you wish to reserve?
Yeah, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. May it please the court, Cal Potter and Gerald Neal on behalf of Jesus Orozco, the plaintiff appellant. Knowing that this court is familiar with the facts of this case, I'd like to focus on why the trial court erred in granting summary judgment on this matter. What we were looking for is a straight application of the Ortega Concrete Pumping case to the facts of our matter, as well as the reliance of the NRS 616B 603, which has been codified Mears test in a unique situation, of course, in this particular area of the law, is that the court ruled as to what the Mears test was when it was applicable, and then the legislature then codified it. But it made it clear that in these situations, that when you have a non-licensed contractor or subcontractor, in this instance, Thornton was not a subcontractor, it was not licensed, it could not be licensed. And the court looked at the same facts in the Ortega case on a concrete pumping situation, made a determination that the trial court was incorrect in assuming that merely because they were on the same job site that they had to be and working on the same project, that they had to be governed by the exception under the NIAA Act. In this particular situation that we have in our case, clearly Thornton was not a contractor or subcontractor. The only thing that the court relied upon is the fact that there is a agreement that calls it a subcontractor. But clearly Thornton could not be licensed and it would fall under 616B 603, dealing with what is called an independent enterprise. And because they're governed by the independent enterprise, the court is required to look to all of the factors in making the determination of whether this was done in a normal business. And clearly, this is not the normal business that Marnell Herrera, as the general contractor, would be engaged in.
I mean, looking at Harrison Richards, do we even need to get to independent enterprise? Would it be appropriate for the court to look at the Mears test?
Well, it would, because you have the situations where both cases dealt primarily with property owners. Here you have a situation where the determining issue is whether, in fact, this is a licensed subcontractor, which they are not. So they're governed by a straight application of the codified Mears test at 616B.603. And what is important there is that you then look to, I was looking at the Bill Meyer versus Newmont Mining, where Judge Hagan went through this same analysis, of course, in the federal system, and I know that those cases are merely persuasive and not precedent, but he went through that analysis and he looked at how did we get to where we're at, and made the determinations that this court looked at Larson's on Workman's Comp, which is the one book of treatise governing how you come up with these types of tests. The Mears test was then developed. The Mears test comes into play when you have a situation where you don't have a licensed subcontractor. And the mere fact that they're on the job site does not mean that they're a subcontractor. Nor is the fact that they're engaged in a contract where they're called a subcontractor. What this court looked at in Ortega, and looking at the testimony that was given by the contractors board, is that one, a concrete pumping company could not be licensed as a contractor, and secondly, they were not. And in this particular instance, if they wanted to be governed as a subcontractor, then they should go to the legislature, change the law, and or go to the contractors board, have those administrative rules changed, and then they become a licensed subcontractor, and then they're governed differently. But because they're not a licensed subcontractor, they're governed by 616B.603. And I would submit that based upon that analysis that was done in not only in the Bill Meyer case, but the Ortega case, that they are not statutorily immune because they're not a co-employee, they're not not a co-employer. And in this particular instance, what we're looking at is the normal work test, because they clearly are not involved in the same type of work, just as in the Newmont mining cases, whether the drilling that was hired would normally have been done by employees. Clearly, the work of Thornton would not have been done by the employees of Marnell.
Didn't we retreat from that language in Tucker later on?
As it pertains to the licensed subcontractor. I don't believe so. And that's the argument that was made that Lips was the controlling case. And clearly, Lips was sending the bad paid in Gulf Western. Gulf Western was a licensed contractor. Lips was involved with Southern Nevada Paving being governed, and Southern Nevada Paving is also a licensed contractor. The test that is going to take away is the control test, which isn't the same as the normal work test. The normal work test deals with whether in this particular instance, the independent enterprise is in the same business as Marnell Carrera, who is the general contractor.
Don't we have some issues, though, if we look at Ortega and then look at Harris, the Harris case?
Yes.
As to general contractors and landowners are immune from commonwealth suits?
This isn't a landowner.
I understand that, but still.
And that's the big distinction. That was a public policy argument, Your Honor, looking at whether, in fact, you wanted people to, as landowners, to hire licensed contractors. That was a public policy argument, dealing with that theory that if you have immunity, then people would go out as the general public, hire licensed contractors, and then they would have immunity. So you don't have that same issue here. You have a straight application of a contractor who hired Thornton Concrete, but they didn't hire him as a subcontractor because they legally cannot be a subcontractor. So it's similar to what occurred in the Ortega case, where the judge says, well, they're both on the same job site, they must be a subcontractor. And what that said and what the statute says, and what I look at in terms of going through the analysis of Judge Hagan and Deb Bellmeyer, is he says, no, you have to look beyond those factors of whether there's a contract or not, because if there was a contract and they were a subcontractor, then there would be complete immunity. But because they're not a subcontractor, they fall under 616B.603. Under subsection 2, it talks about holds a business or occupational license. Clearly, Thornton has a business license. He owns, rents, or leases property. That's what we're dealing with here, is a concrete boom pumping system that was rented or leased from concrete repair manufactured by Schwinn. And then a principal contractor who is licensed pursuant to 624 is immune. It doesn't apply. But Thornton is not licensed under 624 of the NRS. And a real estate broker goes through the other exceptions. So because they are not licensed, that is the key to this particular matter.
And it's not to distinguish Richards at all?
I'm sorry?
Do you need to distinguish the Richards case at all?
I don't believe Richards is contrary to it, because once again you're dealing with situations where you're hiring and giving immunity to the property owners, or in that instance, to the hotel. We're dealing here with an independent enterprise, and that's what this is. It is not a subcontractor. It's not a contractor. It's not a property owner. And that's what makes this case different than all of the other fact patterns other than Ortega or the Bellmeyer case, because those are the facts that make that unique. We're not dealing with a property owner here on the immunity of the Wynn, or we're not dealing with Marnell, who is clearly a licensed contractor, or some other licensed subcontractor. What we're dealing with is an unlicensed, in terms of a contracting license, with this particular entity. And so it's clearly an application of 616B of the MERS test.
Is there any significance to the fact that Thornton bought into Marnell's OCIP, well, as far as its relationship as a subcontractor, as you characterized Thornton?
Yeah, because if they wanted to do that and be governed by it, then they would have to go and be changed under the law. Clearly, the mere fact that they bought into that insurance does not make them a subcontractor. That would be something you go to the legislature and put another exception in here in 616B.603. They didn't do that. What they did is they attempted to foster the appearance of a subcontractor, used a subcontractor AIA type agreement.
Right, so wouldn't that be one of the factors that you would consider in trying to determine their status?
No, because you would go to the statute and you'd look whether they're a contractor or not. If that were true, then you would change the statute. All we're looking for is an application of the statute, which is the MERS test, which was adopted by the legislature from the ruling of this court in MERS. And if you wanted to change it and look to those other factors, then those are something you would put in the statute. Because now it's codified. So now we're asking for an application of the plain meaning. And where the trial court got lost was they looked at that and they said, well, there's a contract here. But it's not a contract between a normal contractor license and a licensed subcontractor. And that's where the Ortega fact analysis comes into play. So what you're saying is the OSIP, does that counter that? Does that trump that?
No, it's just a factor that perhaps we ought to consider.
Well, if you were a licensed contractor, then you wouldn't be here because they'd have a written agreement.
And in this particular case, he couldn't get a license.
It's not that he couldn't. He wasn't qualified, yes. I mean, he could not be a subcontractor because he cannot be a subcontractor.
Well, were there licenses available for this type of process?
No. And that's what Ms. Berger is the one on Ortega that testifies from the contractors board. But the type of service is not a contracting situation because they don't build, they don't construct, they don't haul. But they're a hybrid situation, and because they are, they kind of come under the MERS test as an independent enterprise.
Thank you. Mr. Potter, I just had a question on the attorney's fees award. My understanding is a $10,000 offer of judgment. The court awarded fees based upon your client not accepting the offer of judgment. The order, though, was entered doesn't reflect an analysis of the Beatty versus Thomas factors. It's just a summary order. However, it does reference the pleadings, which do discuss Beatty versus Thomas and all. What's your position on, first of all, the propriety of the award and the sufficiency of the order?
Well, Your Honor, in that respect, we were countering that by saying that also the motions talk about bad faith, the briefs talk about bad faith. Though the offer of $10,000 doesn't even come close to covering the cost in the case, we survived summary judgment because initially in the case it was written to the Supreme Court, it wasn't accepted. It wasn't ruled out on the merits, but it wasn't accepted. Mm-hmm. There was another motion for summary judgment. In the meantime, most of the evidence and most of the people that were deposed were out of Minnesota, so there was a great deal of time and effort spent. In terms of the damages that were involved here, it didn't come close in terms of the value of the case, and based on the fact that we'd survived the summary judgment, on the other issues that are now really before this court once again.
Was that a 56F request?
Yes.
On the first summary judgment?
Well, not in the first, but in the last, it was also 56.
So the
part of it was that we needed to do additional discovery also in the first one.
Counsel, we just, we're cutting into your time, we'll give you 3 minutes on rebuttal, but the posture of the case and the time this came before the court, I understand there had been settlement as another part of the case with the other two parties.
Yes.
And I guess the operative question was, when the court was reviewing it, looking at the two defendants that were left in, wasn't the court basically saying, you know, why are we still here? As to these two parties based upon what was being pled and the product liability claims?
No, I don't believe the court got into that at all, Your Honor. I don't know what went through the mindset of the court to make the determination that it did, but clearly we had a good faith belief, and I believe as I stand here today, he was completely wrong in his analysis, and he got looking at this contract and assuming the contract is dispositive, which it isn't because of the nature of Thornton Concrete.
Well, I mean, you have two issues you seem to be pushing that's left in terms of this. One is as to whether or not they were co-employees, and the second is whether this falls into kind of a defective product type case because of the Wells issue.
Correct, and the fact that you have a defective product as to the manufacturer and then to the concrete pumping system. Clearly what was to occur here was that Thornton was supposed to call upon concrete pumping to come in and do the inspections. They were never done. Instead, what they were doing is a race to the top of that hotel to finish the pumping.
There seemed to be information in what we've reviewed that they found that Thornton was doing the timely inspection, so to speak, of the equipment.
No, he wasn't, and that's the factual issue that was involved there, Your Honor. He was supposed to do inspections every 500 hours. He had told OSHA that it was only needed to be done on a yearly basis. Clearly, they weren't doing the inspections as needed, and he was confusing the two different pumps and trying to get, based on the fact that he had multiple pumps on the site, that he was acting in a prudent manner, which he wasn't. And it's an old, old pumping system, and it checked. When there was a problem with the guide valves and all the welds were done in the field, they weren't supposed to be doing the field welds. They were supposed to have certified welds done by concrete pumping system.
Thank you. As indicated, we'll give you 3 minutes on rebuttal. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Alexander McLeod on behalf of respondent Thornton Concrete Pumping, who was the defendant down below, and the movement. So I got the opportunity to go first and rebut, and now the tables have turned. When the court has been able to clarify the answers to its questions, and hopefully the parties have been able to do a good job in illuminating those issues for the court through our arguments today, we will ask the court to go back and review this case and affirm Judge Villani's ruling from the trial court level to find that Thornton and Orozco were statutory co-employees working together to construct the WIN. We believe Judge Villani's ruling was correct for several reasons. We believe the facts of this case support that. We've outlined those in our brief, and certainly I'll touch on several of those issues. Another reason we believe Judge Villani's ruling to be correct is because this case is distinguishable from Ortega. And the third reason we believe that Judge Villani's ruling is correct is because the policies behind the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act and its immunities supports a finding that Thornton and Orozco were co-employees.
Do we need to look at the Mears test here at all?
We do not believe that we get to the Mears test. We believe that the clarification since the time Ortega was decided gets us to that decision before we ever get to the Mears test. Because of the factual similarities between our case and Ortega, which basically said, remanded the case and said, please look at the Mears test, we thought that it would behoove us to do an analysis of the Mears test just in case, so that this court wouldn't be put in the same position as the Ortega court, remand and look at that, because we made sure that we brought that issue to Judge Villani's attention and briefed it for him. And Judge Villani's findings and conclusions actually went to both the case law and finding a statutory and co-employee, as well as the Mears test. So both of those grounds would be before you should we find ourselves in the position we do today on appeal. The Ortega case specifically is distinguishable from our case because in the Ortega case, there was no contract. It is clearly set forth in the beginning of the Ortega case at, I even have the citation, and that's at page 1361 of the Ortega case. There was no contract between LVP, or Las Vegas Paving, and Ortega did not have and was not required to have a contractor's license. Right there, our case is distinguishable from that because Thornton Concrete Pumping did have a subcontract agreement with Marnell Correo. Marnell Correo contracted with the landowners to construct the WIN, to construct it out of concrete, and had, in order to meet the terms of Marnell's obligations to the WIN, Marnell would have had to somehow provide concrete pumping services, and instead of doing it themselves, they decided to subcontract a portion of that to Thornton Concrete Pumping. Thornton Concrete Pumping leased equipment, brought it to the site, and we had an operator who's operating the concrete pump on one end. There's a hose that goes up to the top floors of the wing, where Mr. Orozco is on the other end of the hose pouring the concrete. They're working in tandem to complete the work that Marnell Correa was contractually obligated to do, which is build the wind out of concrete.
Mr. Carter made a point about them with a license and that they couldn't get a license, not just the fact that they weren't licensed, but they couldn't get one. Is that important to us to consider?
I believe that one of the lessons we learned from the Lips case is that it's not Thornton's license that's important, it's Marnell's license that's important. In the Lips case, C&J Trucking was not a licensed subcontractor, but the court in the Lips case extended the immunities to C&J Trucking and its employees because they were working under the contractor's license. Here we have a similar situation where the general contractor, Marnell Correa, has a license pursuant to Chapter 624. Specifically, if we look at the statutes, at NRS 16B.603, at subsection 3, it says the provisions of this section did not apply to a principal contractor who is licensed pursuant to Chapter 624 of NRS, making Marnell Correa a statutory employer. Thornton Concrete Pumping does not submit that it is a statutory employer of Mr. Orozco. We make the distinction that Thornton Concrete Pumping is an employee through its subcontract with Marnell, and therefore the provisions of 616B.603, which says a person is not an employer, right, ER, does not apply to Thornton Concrete Pumping. What we need to look at, consistent with the reasoning and analysis in the Lips case, is Marnell's license. And that's what's important, not whether Thornton was licensed or not. Certainly, Ortega is also distinguishable because it relies at least in part on the construction versus non-construction analysis of Tucker, which was overruled by this court in the Richards case. The other interesting element that we learned from the Ortega case is that the court there specifically rejected the argument that concrete pumping is simply, I think they refer to it as a mere supplier. And they did focus on the licensing issue, particularly with that construction versus non-construction rationale behind them. But the rationale that the legislature and this court has found in extending immunities is to basically reward individuals or companies for paying into the program to protect workers. The trade-off, right, is employers pay into this program in order for there to be a fund to compensate injured workers regardless of fault. And that's different from our usual system. Usually we make a fault finding before we turn to compensation. And so in exchange for that, for taking on a broader definition of what's compensable, the reward is we'll make you immune from suit if you agree to do this. That's the same rationale that supports extending the immunities to landowners, because we want to encourage those landowners to use the workers who are licensed, and one of the licensing requirements under 624 is that they pay into the workers' compensation system. So if, say, a homeowner could get cheaper labor by using someone unlicensed that didn't have a workers' compensation program in place, we would discourage that in favor of employing someone who would protect their workers. Here, Thornton Concrete Pumping paid into that system to protect all the workers on that project constructing the wind should something happen. Unfortunately, something did happen to Mr. Orozco, and that is quite unfortunate. but that's what the owner-controlled insurance program was meant to do, was to compensate him in case something happened. And that program did what it was supposed to do and did compensate Mr. Orozco. In addition to that, people who had not paid into the system, the manufacturer and distributor of the equipment that failed, they then could proceed, Mr. Orozco could proceed against suit against them because they did not have the same protections of the immunities. If we were to ask Thornton Concrete Pumping to comply with the terms of its contract and pay into the OSIP, and then have that OSIP pay out to an injured worker, but allow that worker to turn around and sue, we would be undermining the very purposes, reasoning, and rationale for the workers' compensation program and its corresponding immunities to make it work. The more we chip away at those immunities, the less motivation, for lack of a better term, employers are going to have to pay into it. Because
we understand the overall concept of the plan. The question is whether or not they truly fit under that umbrella. That's really what's before us right now. And if you comment briefly as to whether or not this issue, this products liability issue, potential products liability issue in the world, pushes us outside, is there any legs to that argument?
Certainly we believe that the Nolan case speaks directly to the secondary argument as Thornton Concrete Pumping as a remanufacturer of the concrete pump and the boom that failed in this case. We believe that a very similar argument was made in the Nolan case and rejected by the court. Nevada does not recognize the dual capacity, and to say, well, in addition to being a co-employee, they're also a remanufacturer, which is a term from the pleadings in this case, not a term from the Nolan matter. That's simply inconsistent, and I believe the rationale is not explained to us in the Nolan case, but I believe that the rationale behind it would be fitting with those same protections for extending immunity to allow that program to work under Nevada's workers' compensation. And our workers' compensation program is unique in that we do extend the protections to subcontractors and independent contractors, and they are accorded the same status as employees. That's something that we do here in Nevada to protect our employers at the same time as we're trying to protect our workers. And that's a unique Nevada benefit. And that rationale will be forwarded in this case by affirming the ruling from Judge Villani and finding that Thornton Concrete Pumping is a co-employee of Mr. Orozco.
If you would speak to the propriety of the attorney's fees.
Certainly. As been pointed out in some of the pleadings, my former firm actually was involved in the defense of this case as well, and then I left that firm, and I was no longer involved, and then the file was transferred, and so I was actually involved in both summary judgment motions as well in this matter. And with respect to the settling defendants who were offered a good faith settlement, Thornton Concrete Pumping was invited to that party as well, and they declined, believing firmly that they had immunity. The $10,000 offer of judgment that was made after that settlement was pushed through, and the determination of good faith settlement was made, which would entitle Thornton Concrete Pumping, of course, to an offset for that amount of value. Beyond that, we believe that a reasonable evaluation of the exposure to Thornton was $10,000 or less because of what we believed was the immunity statutes on which ultimately we prevailed on. The case was long. It was complicated. There was much discovery that was done. And honestly, if it weren't for negotiated rates by insurance carriers, I believe that the bill submitted to Judge Zalani for his review and our request for attorney's fees, I believe those would be artificially low, comparable to some market values of good and comparable attorneys here in town. We believe that Judge Zalani certainly took the time to do all points necessary in his analysis, even if the order doesn't reflect that. He does refer to the pleadings, and that's all that's required under the law. But Judge Zalani went so far as to request supplemental briefing to make sure that he had complied with all parts of the law on attorney's fees and granting costs before he made that ruling, and we believe it should stand.
What about the lack of findings?
I'm sorry?
The lack of findings?
In the attorney's fees order specifically?
Yes.
Obviously, we have the benefit of looking at hindsight, and would we do things differently? Perhaps. But based on the pleadings, I believe that Judge Zalani was in compliance with the law in referring to those, referring to the facts set forth, and not specifying them in the court order.
I guess the concern we have as justices is that we review this and we're guessing what his thinking process is. Like, for example, Mr. Potter says, how could this possibly be refused in bad faith if based upon the magnitude of the case? And you answered by saying, well, you get a credit for $800,000, so that's a big difference, you know, like that. But if the judge had addressed these things, then we can review it for abuse of discretion.
And certainly there were two grounds submitted to Judge Zalani, and I'm not sure which of the two grounds was his favorite. But I believe that they're both well-founded and support our request for attorney's fees. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to hit on a couple of the issues that were brought up on the Richards case that follows Harris, and I know Your Honor wrote the opinion, but on Harris, but the it says underlying matter involves an NRS Chapter 624 licensed contractor. And that was what the property owner actually deals with in looking at Harrison and in context with Tucker. It changes the control test of Tucker to a different analysis as a factor, but it doesn't touch on the Mears test, on the normal test. And I would just, I don't want to be the same issues, but in the Billmeyer case, there's the same arguments that are made. It's that a principal contractor contracts with an independent, in that instance, it was called an independent contractor for services, does not compel the conclusion that these services are a parceled out fraction of the main job, or in the words of the Mears test, obviously a subcontracted fraction of the main contract. So the fact that you have a contract is not dispositive. The fact that you label it as a subcontractor contract when the individual clearly cannot be licensed as a subcontractor is important in looking at whether there is a following of the statutory requirements as well as the case law here. And clearly there wasn't. I mean, he looked at the same thing that they looked at in Ortega in terms of the fact that they were on the same job site. And we look at it the same thing here on this O'Keefe, the Billmeyer, Newmont Gold, that they're on the same mining site or construction site. And Newmont made the same area where we had a contract with these people. But that isn't dispositive because they're not, one, they're not licensed in this case. And secondly, they could not be licensed. But the third part about it is that they certainly couldn't perform the function under this normal work test as an independent, and what the statute then went to was calling these independent enterprises to make that distinction. So you have this long history, but clearly Thornton does not follow into that pattern. And I'm familiar with the Lips case because it was my case, and that was not what happened. We sued Southern Nevada Paving. C&J Trucking, theory was C&J Trucking worked for the Mojave Indians, and which is a sovereign nation, and therefore he was working for for these entities that were not even governed by the NIA because they were dealing with this Indian reservation. The court, this court found that it went over because he also, in doing the work, was governed by Southern Nevada Paving, which is a subcontractor that was licensed, and Gulf Western was the general contractor, and they were both licensed. So this court held that the application there was you had a licensed contractor, general contractor, and a licensed sub. That's completely different than what we have here. There's no license, nor could there be any license for Thornton Concrete. And those that there may be a factor that you would look at in making these determinations, but it's not dispositive of what we're looking at here over the years and formulating whether you could sue another. What we're saying is he's a sub-manufacturer because he's doing all this welding out there in the field.
Well, thank Council for their discreet arguments today about mayors and NIA. Mm-hmm. And with that, this matter will stand submitted. Thank you. And we'll recess until 1:30.